Welcome to this podcast of Sunday nights on ABC Local Radio. I hope you enjoy the program. Our new Prime Minister, Julia Gillard, quotes the lack of a broad public consensus as being one reason for hastening slowly on an emissions trading scheme and legislation on climate change. Well, this week in Melbourne, representatives of three faith traditions, Muslim, Christian and Jewish, gathered to find an Abrahamic consensus for greening with God. It's a pleasure to welcome into our studios tonight Mark Peterson, the interfaith representative for the Islamic Council of Victoria, together with Rabbi Shamir Kaplan, president of the Jewish Christian Muslim Association, and Sister Anne Lanyon of the Columbans and their interfaith network. Welcome to you all.
Hi, John.
Thank you so much for joining us. Now, could I get each of your initial reaction to what you thought when you heard Julia Gillard say about the climate change and ETS, look, this issue is one that lacks a broad community consensus. A little chill of fear go down your spine, Anne Lanyon?
More than a chill of fear, I disagree with what she said. I feel that there is a consensus.
Rabbi Kaplan.
I appreciate her desire to, or her feeling the need to indicate that this is a complicated issue and therefore reasonable minds will disagree and that we need to build consensus. I suppose it's quite hard to gauge what the world thinks or what Australia thinks about this. To the extent that there isn't complete consensus, it indicates that those of us who are particularly concerned about the current situation of the world and its relationship to the environment need to redouble our efforts in that regard.
Mark Peterson, what were your thoughts?
Well, I think that there is a broad consensus around the need for action. I think what Julia Gillard's reflecting is the inability to come to a consensus around what action to take. And I think where there's the greatest dispute is probably in the vested interests of business.
It's also been noised about that the ironic reason for Kevin Rudd's precipitate decline being the abandonment of an ETS scheme, him seeming to walk away from the great moral issue of our times, but the press are saying actually the reason that he did it was a very reluctant reason and in part was due to the polling done by the New South Wales branch of the Labor Party and others on the impact of the real costs of an ETS being foisted on the public. That is, rises to electricity bills and other costs, which would have a devastating impact in the public opinion polls when people got a sense of the real impact of an ETS. And perhaps that's part of the problem that Julia Gillard is alluding to. It's one thing to get people warm and fuzzy over the environment, it's another thing for them to contemplate substantial rises in the cost of living and cuts to the lifestyle and quality of life for people, some of whom are finding it pretty hard going at the moment. Rabbi?
I think that's very true, and I also think that I suppose some people would wonder why it is that this is a religious issue or why some of us see it as a religious issue, and I think it particularly for the issues you've raised of the economics involved, I think it's quite relevant. And that is to say, if people really are not just going to sort of hold the slogan of yes, I care about the world around me, and yes, we should be committed to it, and yes, the government should, and business should. But yes, when it comes down to it, ultimately each of us has to take responsibility for our life and our lifestyle, and has to be willing to think openly and broadly. And for people of faith, my sense of coming to the world from a perspective of faith constantly involves that notion of reevaluating, of looking at yourself, being honest, and asking yourself, what are the real underpinnings of my life and my commitments, and what am I willing to give for that? Not that I believe we should live an ascetic life at all, but that ability to ask yourself, what am I willing to give up or to change? Am I willing to change? I think is a fundamentally religious question, although obviously it's asked outside of that context as well.
Anne Lanyon, do you think the public are ready to change profoundly? If the shock comes and, you know, 20% rise in your electricity bills, people aren't going to like that.
Yeah, it definitely will be a shock, but I think the times require us to really face those hard questions. It is a difficult one for people who are running really close to the breadline to face these sorts of things. And I guess they ask the question, how much are big corporations, how much are those who can afford this contributing? If I'm going to be sacrificing something, I expect those who are maybe contributing to the problem in larger ways will play their part. So I think there's that sense of a justice issue involved in that. But I do think that people realise that we have to make sacrifice for the common good.
Yes, and I guess, Mark Peterson, that fear of what would be said of the cost impost on the ordinary person, when in fact many corporations, and particularly the Greens were pointing this out, were, according to the ETS formula being adopted by the Rudd government, the Greens were pointing out that many businesses were in fact getting so much in the way of concessions that it meant that real targets were just ridiculous. And so there was an inequity built into that scheme which would have opened them up to great criticism. And this is going to be a continuing problem as one approaches the politics of something like this.
Which I think comes back to two things, really. And there was some real discussion in some of our time at the conference just recently about the genuine locus of power within our community. To what extent is that lying within large corporates and media that have an influence on public opinion, and to what extent does that sense of public opinion really, or the responsibility for that, really lie with us as individuals? And I think that to a large extent the push for dealing with climate change does arise from the realisation that people are genuinely concerned at the individual level, and yet it's very easy to then turn around and run a bit of a scare campaign and scare people about their super or other things being impacted by something like an ETS, and to basically turn that public opinion back again. And I think that's where, as Shamir was indicating, there's a need for, at the individual level, for us to really be, I think, steadfast or focused on the particular goals that would see us through and not be basically pushed around by those kind of waves of influence and public opinion, if you like.
The point you make, Mark, about locus of power is, of course, critical in any discussions that we have tonight, because there's a sense in which faith groups, particularly the Abrahamic faiths, who represent a majority of those Australians who still consider themselves as committed to their faith tradition, have an enormous impact on their own communities. Yet it's within those communities, within the Jewish, Muslim and Christian communities, even within these communities, there is a profound lack of consensus. And Lanyon, one only needs to point, for example, to the Catholic community, where the views of Cardinal Archbishop Pell have known to edge towards the climate sceptic end of the discussion. Yet an active Columban who's been in Australia many times, Sean McDonough, is one of those advocating an urgent remediation of the ills besetting the planet. So even faith traditions can't seem to get their act together here.
Well, there's always going to be a broad cross-section of views in a faith tradition, and the Christian tradition is such a broad church that that's fairly natural. But there are common understandings and teachings that we would have in common. But I guess our worldview comes from our experience, and Sean's experience has been with the poor people, the Tiboli people, the indigenous people in southern Philippines, where he received what you would call an ecological conversion from his experience. And so he's been teaching on that for well over 30 years.
Yes, but it does go to this question of consensus, doesn't it? That is, that a consensus is something that Julia Gillard perhaps is right, that it doesn't exist out there in a broad community, it doesn't exist across faith traditions, nor does it exist within faith traditions.
I think maybe yeah. Shamir, do you want to say something about what Ian was putting forward?
Well, yes, one of my rabbinic colleagues who was present at and involved actually in the planning of the conference made the point that, I'll use my own words for it, that the notion of stewardship and, if you want to call it, ecological responsibility that permeates all three of our traditions, and no doubt all traditions, that notion of responsibility when we think about what our relationship to the world around us is as human beings, that sense of stewardship and responsibility predates, and then I would say avoids the whole climate change debate. And that is to say that wondering what kind of impact we have on the world around us is something that, you know, for thousands of years the Jewish tradition has been concerned about, and you know that's even before we even knew what climate change was. And so there is potential for building consensus on action, even if it's not major action, even if it's not based on very specific assumptions about the climate change issue, that progress can be made and should be started in the near future, as what I believe is that consensus will build. And can I just also say, John, you're asking about within each faith, and I think part of what those of us who are involved in this interfaith kind of engagement around this and in truth around a whole host of issues, what we find is the power of working together with like-minded individuals in other faiths, not necessarily exclusively looking to our co-religionists for support, but really with a broader view, a more global perspective, and finding those who share common values and commitments and understandings in other faiths. I think it helps us find ways of building, helping build consensus within our own communities. It gives us guidance in terms of the practical experience that other faiths have had in dealing with these issues within our communities. And you're 100% right. A lot of work needs to be done within our own communities to build that kind of not just consensus about the issues, but willingness to act. And I also have to say that when, from an interfaith perspective, we can approach a broader Australian community and say it's not just the Jews or the Christians or the Muslims who are saying this, because I think rightly so, there might be a little bit of skepticism when any particular faith group tries to hold the flag of the day, and others might ask, well, maybe that's just a ploy to get people in the door into the church or to the synagogue or the mosque. But when truly different faiths that share a lot but are actually distinct faiths with their own unique theologies find things that they work towards as in a shared way, I think that the broader community sees that this is really not about that faith. It's about the global issue that we as human beings are all facing, and that's about working with integrity towards making the world a better place.
You're on Sunday night on ABC Radio around Australia, on Radio Australia and via the web to the world. John Cleary with you. We're discussing Greening with God, a conference of shared Muslim, Christian and Jewish representatives discussing the future of the environment. And of course, in the light this week of new Prime Minister Julia Gillard's statement that We need to build a shared consensus in Australia that one is lacking at the moment. Let's talk a little about what that shared consensus is thus far, particularly for the three great faith traditions that share the heritage of Abraham, the Jewish, Christian and Muslim traditions, commonly called the Abrahamic traditions. Let's talk a little about that first book, Genesis, where God lays out, according to tradition, his understanding of the relationship between himself and the cosmos and his creation. For many years, a dominant tradition within Christianity was associated with the word dominion, translated from that first chapter of Genesis, that God gave humanity dominion, and that meant the power to exploit, that everything in the created order was there for humanity to exploit. Let's get from Mark Peterson first, and then Rabbi Shimi Kaplan, a view from the Muslim and Jewish traditions about that those first few books of the Bible, and just how the faith traditions interpret God's relationship with humanity and creation. Mark, you first.
Sure. I mean, I think there's actually a lot of commonality in terms of the language, but it's really important to get the right interpretation. And I think the emphasis was made across the conference this weekend that has... particularly the translation of the word dominion has really been a mistranslation. Within the Islamic tradition, there is the use of the word khalifa, or often translated as vice-regent, which you might think of as being the same kind of idea, in charge of everything and able to use that as you wish, but that concept is really very strongly linked with the concept of the earth as an amana, as a trust. So this is something that the concept within the Islamic framework is that the earth is a trust that has been given to us to look after. And there's even a tradition which suggests, perhaps whimsically, that the angels believe that humans were not fit to look after the earth, and they will create mischief and war and destroy all that is good. And it's almost as if there's a bit of a bet going on that humans may actually be able to not do that. So far, I think we're on the losing side, but this is the challenge to get it right before the end of the day.
Is that a generally shared tradition, or is it a tradition that you only see in some parts of Islam?
Oh, I think that concept of khalifa and amana is a very generally shared tradition, and the idea of the earth as being a trust that we need to look after is very important. And you only have to spend a little bit of time in the desert to appreciate how much people value the natural resources that they do have available to them.
Mm. Mm. Shamir Kaplan, in the Jewish tradition, does the dominion theology that we so often associate with conservative Christianity have some place in Jewish theology as well, or is it a different tradition entirely?
You know, I'm so glad that you raised the issue of that particular part of Genesis and indeed that particular word. I have to say, though, it's we're all able to cherry pick verses here and there to suit our needs if we want to. I think a more holistic look at the text, for instance, if you look at the first two chapters, which really present two very different takes on the creation of humanity, and this is aside from the question of whether you view Genesis as a history book or that answers the question of how and which is the way I prefer to view it, as rather as a book that's talking about the question of why we're here and what our relationship to the earth should be. And I think if you put the first and second chapters of Genesis together, you get very different pictures that are both crucial, quite a dualistic model. So that first hierarchic, you see this language of dominion in Hebrew, lirdot, to have dominion over, comes in the first chapter, that is a very hierarchical one, and man sits on the top of this hierarchy, at least on Earth. And that certainly presents that notion of that we have this power and authority. But immediately after that, the Bible discusses in the second chapter a totally different kind of creation story, if you will, where the earth is waiting for humanity to be created, and by the way, is created from as a marriage of the dust of the earth and the sort of the spirit of godliness, which I think is also particularly pregnant in terms of our conversation. And the language there is la'avda ul'shomra, which means that humanity's responsibility is to work and serve and guard the garden, but that is to say the world. So you've got on the one hand this notion of authority and power, control, if you will, and on the other this charge to serve, to work, to protect, to guard. And taken together, I think that creates a much more nuanced and balanced and comprehensive perspective, rather than a much more simplistic read of the role of man or the power of man.
And within rabbinic traditions, have there been, of course, variations over the years, but is there any sort of consistent, coherent theme that has emerged over recent years? And how widespread or divergent are the extremes of those views? As wide as in Christianity, for example?
Look, you'll always, we have a rich tradition, and you know, we say that the Bible has, the Torah has 70 faces to it. That is to say, I envision it as the metaphor of a prism with 70 sides. And that tells me that depending where I'm standing and the way I look at it will determine what it is that I'm able to see in it, because it's such a rich thing. And what I see, you won't see. And what you see, I might not see. But that, which is why for us it's such an important tradition to study, and to study in partnership with others, to explore together, so we'll have the benefit of each other's eyes in seeing something that's greater than both of us. But so of course there's going to be diversity, but I want to point out a beautiful teaching about that particular word of dominion that I think sort of sheds light on what I would say is consensus within the Jewish tradition, and that is the word lirdot is a unique word used in that context, the term for dominion. And the rabbinic literature, which you asked about, points out that that word is quite similar to the word laredet, which means to descend. And what the rabbis learned from that is that if humanity approaches the world in the appropriate way, which I guess in our common parlance would be the language of sustainability, then there will be that sense of good stewardship. But if man abuses that authority and that control, that ability to at least have quasi-control, then they will descend, and that really they will suffer the consequences of the natural world. And I think that's particularly powerful for us in the modern context.
It's interesting that you mentioned the perspective of the lens. Only recently on the program we had Norman Hebel, the Lutheran theologian, who was writing about those first few books of Genesis as very hard books to come to terms with. One wants to come to terms with environmental theology. He, for instance, pointed to not only the difficulties of Genesis, but even the story of the Ark, of Noah and the Ark. I mean, the attitude of a God who sort of wants to wipe it out, and then, you know, the whether or not the creation is there to serve mankind, or mankind is there as part of the created order, seems to be wrestled with and interpreted differently according to how you read even a story like that. But one of the interesting things that you mentioned as coming out of this lens through which you see it is that every generation, of course, meets new problems, and so it's right. As much a new light, I guess, being shed on it that helps illuminate what it's about.
Right, right. We say we have a statement in the Talmudic teachings that we're enjoined to turn over and turn over, and I guess it's a ironic term to use in this context, but to really mine our tradition for and our sacred texts for meaning, because everything is within it. And so to the extent that we're looking with different eyes, we're going to see different things that might not have been noticed before.
Anne Lanyon, Catholic teaching has something else associated with it too, in not just biblical theology, but alongside that is natural theology. That is, God is revealed through his creation to us. And that seems to be an important element, a new understanding of the sort of natural theology that comes through a lot of environmental teaching too. I don't want to make too strong a point about it, but there is a sense there in which that's all being rethought as well.
Well, I guess it's been there through church history, where we talk about the altar of the world, and God is reflected or mirrored in the beauty of creation. But yes, I think you're right that now, because of gradually we're unfolding with new eyes, and the earth is really speaking to us and helping us to see this through new eyes. And I guess we can look to the indigenous people to help us see that with new eyes. So yes, I think that's very true. And the other aspect of this too is the work of Thomas Berry in looking at the new story of creation. We had on the first evening of the conference input from Anne Boyd from Earthsong, who presented a new framework for all of the traditions that results from the work of Thomas Berry, where we look at the whole history of the universe from the 13.7 billion years since the Big Bang theory and that first flaring forth, to bring a new story of creation that is resonating more with young people of today and with our greater understanding of the earth in the whole scheme of things. We have a different view of the earth through technology, through space exploration, and so we're able to look at this cosmic understanding of creation.
There's an interesting problem there for each of the traditions. Anne Lanyon, we're all familiar with the arguments that conservative elements in Christianity would put up against environmental theology. In fact, there was an argument in one of the major weekend papers a couple of weeks ago. The Weekend Australian contained an article saying it was Christians' duty to oppose environmentalists because they were out to basically sell out the principles of Christianity to paganism and pantheism and every other sort of New Ageism that was going around. Do similar stories and lectures get made in certain circles in Islam, Mark, when one is trying to mount arguments for a sympathetic view of responsibility for the environment?
I guess I don't have a finger on the pulse of every mosque around the planet. For that, you might want to talk to people at Langley or somewhere like that. But
we'll rely on your general sensibility for the moment.
Sure, but I don't think there's that kind of opposition within the Islamic community. I mean, if anything, I think there's unfortunately maybe just an ignorance of the issue or a non-discussion of the issue. It may be seen as tangential to people's general concerns, and particularly if you're looking at large populations in the two-thirds world where their own survival may be more of an issue. But clearly I think there is concerns about the environment arising in those countries for that very reason. I think there is still that real
sense. But it is very easy to see how, for those who follow the traditions, basically outlined in the Bible, these cries that anything to do with environmentalism is getting, has tinges of nature worship to it, the very things which Muhammad opposed in his first prophetic utterances. It's old paganism coming.
No, I disagree, and I think, I mean, you can turn to verses of the Quran that say things like, "O people, worship your Lord, who's appointed the earth as a resting place for you and the sky as a canopy, and causes water to pour down from the sky and therefore produces fruits as food for you. And do not set up rivals to God when you know better." And I think what that, putting those two things together, and it's really significant, saying that, look, the earth and nature has been provided for you as a means of your sustenance, and do not be distracted by other gods or other forms of worship. And I think that takes on a particular resonance in our very consumerist society, where I think it's our desire to have more and to fulfill our sense of self-importance through perhaps material acquisition that is really driving a lot of the environmental destruction. So I don't see an environmental message as being one that is in conflict with a true understanding of monotheism and the responsibility that places upon us.
Can I also add
Shamir
something?
Kaplan, yes.
I think that's, in particular, I think in terms of Islam and Judaism, if I may, Mark, that there's a certain element of the importance of law. Because up until now we've been speaking about sort of general narratives of the Bible and sort of the more conceptual. But, you know, for Jews, in their relationship with the sacred text is not just about the ideas. It's very much about the, certainly from the Orthodox perspective, about the action that is expected of us and the different mitzvot or commandments that emerge from the text. And so to really deal, and I know that with Islam, that's at the very least, it's also something we share in common. And so in the over the course of this week weekend of discussing our own faith's perspectives on these issues, we haven't just spoken about those conceptual texts, but also about the commandments that have a very clear and practical and mundane ecological dimension to them, and then sort of extrapolate, whether it's about the avoiding wanton destruction, whether it's about issues involving city planning or avoiding of pollution of communities, the notion of that the land needs to rest and recover in the sabbatical year. It's very concrete, if you will, expectations of our behavior that we can draw sort of thematic lessons from. But so it's not just in the level of, you know, our tradition it teaches us or inspires us in these areas, not just in terms of the broader statements, but also in terms of this concrete expectations of how we are to behave, how we're to live our daily lives.
And can I come in there too, John, when you talked about the people being afraid of the worship of nature becoming pantheistic? There's the difference between pantheism and panentheism, where we see God reflected in nature, God in all. And then if people who are saying those things are really going against the teachings of the church. We've had Pope John Paul II and again Pope Benedict calling for an ecological conversion. We have so much of Jesus' mission was done out amongst natural things. So many of the parables refer to environmental surroundings. And again, in the liturgy of the Eucharist, we at the beginning of the Eucharist, we have "Blessed are you, Lord God of all creation," and we talk about the gifts, the fruit of the earth, the work of human hands. So I think those people who are talking about these things are really expressing a fear that it's not really resonating with what the teachings of our faith is all about.
You're on Sunday Night on ABC Radio Around Australia. We're talking about the environment, a conference this weekend of the Jewish, Christian and Muslim Association of Australia, convened to talk about greening with God. It took place in the light of Julia Gillard's comment, Prime Minister Julia Gillard, that there is a lack of a broad public consensus on climate change, and that needs to change before we can have substantial change in government regulation. Now, that, of course, begs the question about whether government should lead or follow public opinion. That's another question. But you might wish to comment and share your observations about leading to a consensus on climate change. And also, you may have questions about the various faith traditions, Jewish, Christian and Muslim, and what they particularly teach on the environment. 1-300-800-222 is the number to call. 1-300-800-222. Any observations you might have on this question to our guests. And our guests in the studio are Rabbi Shamir Kaplan, the president of JACMA, the Jewish Christian Muslim Association, Sister Anne Lanyon of the Columbans and their Faith and Environment Network, and also Mark Peterson, interfaith representative of the Islamic Council of Victoria. So do give us a call, 1-300-800-222. We've got time for a few calls before the top of the clock on Sunday night on ABC Radio around Australia, through Radio Australia, and via the web to the world. Let me ask just briefly before we take some calls, Shamir Kaplan, what were the highlights of this weekend's discussions for you?
Well, this is the second conference. We have annual conferences. Well, the organization itself does a host of different kinds of programs, which maybe if you want me to talk about, I can, but I won't thrust that upon
we'll
you.
Put details up on our website afterwards. Yes. And people, if they want to know about JACMA, can go to our website and get it. But just for this conference, Greening with
yes.
God.
Yes, you know, it's just exceptional to me to have the opportunity to, because this is a residential conference, and quite consciously so, it gives us the opportunity that just attending sessions or day-long programs even don't provide. And that is when you're in residence with people in the mountains for a few days, and you really spend, you know, evenings over dinner and tea and discussing these issues until the wee hours of the morning. And it's just an exceptional opportunity to experience one another, not just understand and learn about each other, but to really experience one another, people of different faith, to find the areas of confluence, to appreciate the significant and important areas of difference, to treat those differences with dignity. I find that energizing and very hopeful. We've had amazing conversations on a whole range of topics as a community in the years that we've been doing this, and it's amazing to see kids who are preteens attending with their parents, and we have some 90-year-olds attending as well, full of passion, listening to each other, learning from each other, and I just find that really energizing.
Mark Peterson, Anne Lanyon mentioned the need the lessons we can take from looking not just at the similarities and differences between faiths within that Abrahamic tradition that Jews, Christians and Muslims share, but even moving a step outside that and looking, say, at our Australian landscape and what we can gain from Aboriginal traditions and the way in which things like the dreaming and the lessons of the dreaming are interpreted. That must be a difficult thing for people in some traditions to accept how does a Muslim regard the faith traditions that are outside the fold of the Judeo-Christian Islamic tradition? What can one learn from these other traditions?
I think it's probably less problematic than you think, simply because there's a very strong understanding within Islam that to every people there has been a revelation or a prophet, and that really these messages are coming from the one source and should be consistent. Certainly there's been very long history of contact between Islam and the Australian Aboriginal community going back as far as probably 1,200 years. Early contact from
Indonesia through the
from
traders,
Indonesia and so forth. And I see no difficulty in looking at Dreamtime stories and the wisdom that's inherent within Aboriginal tradition as a way of understanding the landscape, particularly the local landscape. And I think even modern scholars, and I've had discussions with them when I've been travelling through Spain, and these might be folk that now live in the UK or the US, but perhaps studied in Yemen, have a very keen sense of wherever you are living, the society that you're living in, the landscape that you're living in, all of those things very strongly inform the way that you understand and practice your religion. So I think it's very important, and there's a huge respect for the wisdom that's contained within other traditions.
Let's take some calls to Bridget in Mitcham. Hello, Bridget. Thanks for joining us.
Hello, John. One of your speakers there tonight spoke about, and he said, and then there must be action. I'm pretty active in environmental groups, particularly around water issues and issues associated with water, like forestry and vegetation and so forth. Now, I'm a member of two large secular organisations. I'm a member of a faith community organisation and an interfaith organisation. And one thing I'm afraid of is that people are happy to do the personal things, like install the tank, save the water, whatever. But I find that quite often they're ignorant of the issues surrounding decision-making, public policy decision-making, on water issues and forestry issues, and certainly they're not active. So I'm wondering if we're going to see, we have had quietism over the centuries invade Christian traditions, particularly Christian Protestant traditions, and I'm wondering if we're going to see a sort of environmental quietism descend on
yes,
the Christian community.
I'll look after my little bit, but I won't do the big policy stuff.
Exactly, John.
Yes,
exactly.
That seems to be a message that in some ways is compounded by some of the environmentalists who go around. Even David Suzuki at one stage a couple of years ago was saying, look, just concentrate on what you can do in your backyard. It's and both, Anne Lanyon, isn't it? It's difficult to mobilise people.
Oh, yes. Tell me about it. But but I think we have examples of that going on. In our Faith Ecology Network, which is actually broader than the Christian Muslim Jewish Association, we also dialogue with other religious traditions. We actually have people who are lobbying, and we actually also associate with environmental groups, because I think God is present in all people, and while we are motivated from our own particular religious traditions, we respect and acknowledge God in the movement of all these people, and we need to dialogue and listen and learn and get as much knowledge as we can, and then really operate not just at our personal level in our communities, in our faith communities, but also at the policy level. And I think that there is that going on.
We'll take another call. Bridget, thanks for your call. We must move on. Lots of calls on the board. Andrew in Parramatta. Hello, Andrew. Welcome.
Oh, hi. How you going?
Yes, good.
Just to get to the point, I just wondered if it would come to the point of Gaia speak, which is namely an environmental religious order, if you like. I don't know much about
it. Yes, the Earth as an organism.
Eh?
The Earth as an organism.
Well, yeah. I only touched on this briefly years ago, and I thought, well, it's a bit like the Greens in federal politics. And I just wonder if it's too left to say, well, you know, if we look after the planet, you know, that's a good thing, because where we're going to put our stuff if we don't take care of the plates we're actually living on? Is that too much of a stretch?
Well, let's get Shamir Kaplan to comment on that. Of course, it comes out of the Gaia hypothesis, Shamir Kaplan, which right. I'm sure you know about it, but there is a sense in which Gaia has been taken one step further by many, isn't it?
I'm hesitant to comment too much on something that I don't feel that I am an expert in. But I think, you know, some understand that, some take it to that hypothesis to mean that sort of there's divinity in the earth itself. And I guess this sort of touches on what Anne mentioned about the notion of pantheism or panentheism. I'm not sure if that's necessarily what it means. And I think some of the reactionary, as you called it, the religious right, talk about these issues is in response to that, is a fear generated from that. But I don't see why intrinsically any hypothesis needs to a priori be treated with skepticism. There's some amazing teachers within our faith who have, you know, dealing with the questions such, I think, in the broader community considered quite controversial in a religious context such as evolution versus creation and such. And their basic approach has been to say, you know, scientists who are in the pursuit of truth sincerely are doing holy work, and that we need to make space for that and appreciate that it's a complicated reality we're dealing with, and try to find to see how that sort of I suppose in the language you were speaking before, how that creates, gives us another lens at which to look at our tradition, our sacred sources, to see, you know, is there truth in it, or to what extent is there truth in it? I think we have to have a healthy, open mind at looking at the philosophies that are out there, and to see if there's ways, or if not completely, at least partially, that we can learn from it and benefit from it.
We're out of time. There's lots of other calls on the board, and we haven't got time to take them. We've just got a minute left. So what I've got to do is ask you each, and I'll start with you, Mark. Into your community, how is the message being propagated and spread? Is there a beginning of sort of small local groups meeting on this within the Muslim community as Muslims discussing these issues, and how effective is it?
Oh, definitely. I mean, I think one of the speakers at the conference, Brother Geneva, from a group called Zamzam. You know, if you know Zamzam, it's the well of spring of water that is in Mecca. Apparently dating from the time of Abraham. But they are doing work across the country to improve the energy efficiency and water efficiency of mosques and individual houses.
And it's being discussed in an environmental context.
Yeah, exactly.
We're going to have to cut you.
Received an award for that. So.
That's fabulous. We're going to have to cut you short there. I'm sorry we've run out of time. Shamir Kaplan and Anne Lanyon, thank you also for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, John.
This has been a podcast of Sunday Nights on ABC Local Radio. Thank you for listening.